is that? I don't know. They haven't got even masks, eh? Or...
Well, what, I didn't say something exactly. He was chatting to me then.
Yeah.
And he said it was really, he thought the fibre answer was really good. And I was just saying, well, isn't it, you know, kind of interesting that, I actually think that film should be shown to, like, lots of eco-warriors, because it's something that you never hear, I mean, I don't know, this would be better than Fall of the Leap, you never hear about. I said, like, you know, because I mean, I work in an aeroplane factory, and as I've been banging on about, I get slagged off loads for working on aeroplanes. And the attitude that seems to me a lot of the time in the movement is that the people who work in those factories, or technicians, or engineers, whatever, are like kind of the enemy, in, as far as the eco warriors are concerned. And it's interesting to watch that film because you see, you know, the fact that they were creating demands, you know, from the consciousness of the late 60s, they go on to looking at the production process, how it's affecting them. Thinking about what the production process is, whether that stuff needs to be produced, you know, and taking that out into the community. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, is a kind of, well, I'd call it a, you know, a communist movement, but a small C, really, because what it is saying, well, we're actually looking at this from the point of view of being human beings rather than workers or consumers, or, you know, we have to start thinking about what's being produced. And, you know, that it's a shame. I mean, there's a couple of people here today, but that's probably partly where that film needs to go, and obviously there's a lot more to it than that.
I think it's a really important film. Mark and Mark's seen it a lot of times, so he didn't want to say all of it, but a lot of people haven't seen it, and it's a sort of new thing to their eyes. Mark also put on the point about technicians. There's an autonomous in the tradition writer called Sergio Bologna, and Mark mentioned that he theorised the technician as a sort of a meeting point between traditional working class and new technological sort of things and that, and yeah. In Germany it was just an old class technician was thought was the enemy, class enemy, the thief of our skills sort of thing. So I think you're actually right on that. That film could be shown a lot more. I don't know what hasn't been in the world, honestly, but it's a really good film, it's really well made, and it's bring a new perspective, especially to the Anglo discussions, which you just don't see. It's just not there, it's not, yes. I'm glad we did watch that film all the way through rather than just
apart. Yeah, there's no just buy it.
It's interesting thing is the extras to this film, which is an interview with Finzi, one of the technicians who spoke most about the pollution, and it's very, very nice, I think, this interview, very intimate topics about how he at some point realized that Potter O'Brien wasn't able to help him as in his personal life crisis because he was sick, he was seriously ill, and he had to actually try to find out his own ways, like healing and medicine, alternative medicine, which is again very stuff which today's you hear from middle class people, at least in Bristol, but at that time this was the issues people, workers, had to find for themselves. And it's like also Marcos says, in India workers use yoga and use aromatherapy themselves because state health sector is shit, so they are forced to do it and to find the old methods again. And then also, which wasn't said in the film, that he actually died due to cancer, this Finzi, like maybe 5 years ago, or, you know. And there is, is it foundation named after him, or?
Oh, it's an archive, yeah.
He was
arrested under terrorist kind of charge in 79, I think. So that's also not in that bit. I thought they would at least mention it in the main.
The tribute, the personal journey, it's very well formed on the drugs thing as well, I mean obviously, I mean in place I've seen it interestingly in Mexico, there's a Zapatista struggle where large numbers, literally millions of you know, campesinos, both indigenous and mestizo campesinos, you know, can't afford the drugs. I mean, in Mexico, you can buy just about any pharmaceutical you want, including obviously large amounts of dodgy pharmaceuticals, but people can't afford them, they're really expensive. And so, you know, obviously, one part of the Zapatista struggle you know, this sort of global autonomy was to try and seize control of their own health or create a health service within the communities, which is a bit, but a lot of that was based around, you know, kind of, you know, medicinal drugs were taken from plants. There was whole projects out there. So, but that was already going on anyway. I mean, the communities couldn't afford drugs before the uprising of 94, so that's what people did. All they did was turn it, formalised it a bit, made it, you know, put clinics in every community. But it, what, but the point was, is they did not get into a fetishisation of herbal remedies or anything like that. They didn't fetishise it. It wasn't like, oh, we have to, we can't use drugs. We, you know, lots of people were going down there, you know, with these indigenous ideas, you know, fucking nuisance most of the time, I've got to say. But they, you know, they go down with this kind of Western view, indigenous view, where most people have not really had proper health care anyway. So, and, you know, these indigenous were kind of disgusted, but the communities were still using kind of like, you know, proprietary drugs or getting hold of them or through you know, sort of NGOs or whatever. But the attitude was really bad because the Zapatistas understood, you know, their health service understood that they needed to use both. And there was no kind of, it wasn't about ideology, you know, around all this kind of herbal health care or whatever. It was about what was effective. And, you know, that's just a side point, but it's similar to what they were doing now, I guess. So.
Nice. Not related, but this question about, it seems to me that the kind of autonomous or rise movement was partly a response to the fact that the political parties and the unions were not representing them. That came across in that film. And I was wondering whether that was the real basis for the, you know, for that, you know, for the militancy. Obviously, I mean, there's no reason why, say, for example, that migrant workers from the south couldn't have, you know, been incorporated into that union kind of thing. I'd be interested to do a study of ICI, which has got a big petrochemical plant, which I mentioned yesterday in the northeast, where labour relations are very quiescent. You know, they're very, very. There's not really kind of major stories to speak of. And yet the same kind, you know, it was interesting looking at that because I thought, ah, this looks exactly like Teesside. Yeah, it's like home, yeah.
Unlike, yeah, by Liverpool as well.
Yeah. So I was wondering, you know, why in that situation, I mean, was it because ICI, you know, had a better health and safety policy, better environmental policy, and the unions were not necessarily, you know, were not kind of motivated by this kind of, we've all got to work together for the development of the country, like there seemed to be like the communist unions. And whether that was the difference, because it didn't, certainly. It would be interesting to contrast the two kind of situations.
They seem to have an explosion of result, don't they?
Yeah, but I'd say, I mean, I worked in an animal feed mill up in Avon now for 4 years, and in a lab up there, animal feed mill, I'm evil. But I worked in a lab up there, which was, you know, with about, I don't know, it's probably about 50 odd workers up there. There was a lot of workers in the plant, you know, but we were doing the testing of the animal feeds and stuff like that. But you'd think, well, it should be, you know, yeah, but it's actually quite dangerous work, you know. And I've got to say, the time I worked up there, the technicians were the lowest paid. I mean, I started there in 1987, and my wage was £5,500 a year at the time. And in the whole time I was there, it went up to about £7,000, which is really very low, even for the time, extremely low wages. We had, you know, and that workforce, what was totally, it was non-unionised, right? And there had been attempts to unionise it. But what was interesting was that the technicians that we worked with, we went through a lot of that stuff. I mean, if ever you drive over the Avonmouth Bridge, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, down Dalgetty Spillers, which may still be there, I think it is. And if you look over that bridge, as you drive over to the right, you see a big like electricity pylon, and you'll notice everything is dead for about 100 yards around that electricity pylon, because that's where we used to dump all the toxic waste. Which we had to dump it, but yeah.
So that was
just up in Shoreampton. Yeah. So, you know, it was quite normal. I mean, when they were talking about, you know, leaky valves and bad equipment, Dalgetty Spillers was the market leader, right? So it was getting straight, it wasn't like some two-bit operation. It was the market leader in the world. It paid the worst wages and had the worst safety that I know of. And that certainly from the other, there were other plants around the country, but that one there was particularly bad. And it was just like that. It was old equipment. You know, things exploded a lot. But the biggest problem wasn't when things blew up. It was the fact you were being exposed to mercury, you know, and things like toluene and all these carcinogenic things. I mean, I actually got rid of the job because some stuff exploded and threw this thing called pyridine all over me, which was, pyridine's a carcinogen. It also makes you throw up immediately you smell it. So I was throwing up and getting...
Is it an organic chemical?
Yeah, organic chemicals. But the point was, is that when they had like lots and lots of young people working there, you know, between the, literally from 16 onwards, and, you know, we used to have to walk around going like, you know, they hadn't... You know, the way I think Thatcher changed the law, the Koch laws they were called about using the chemicals, yeah. And they made you responsible as an individual, not the company sort of thing. Yeah. So when that happened, the company stopped, they didn't really enforce it anyway, they didn't enforce you wearing safety gear or anything. So we used to walk around, I remember being at a tea break with these, you know, it was about 50 men and women, there was quite a few young women there, and they were like pulling these, what they call tree ball refreshers out of their pockets, right? Oh, I've got a tree ball refresher, and these are the mercury chloride tablets, sure. You know, which are concentrated on mercury in them, we don't touch them. But people just were unaware, and the company didn't care. It didn't go around, because what you should be disciplined, you walk down to have your sandwiches, and people are putting mercury tablets out. It was quite normal, people just fucking about, you know, not aware of how dangerous. We used to say, to, you know, we enforced it as a workforce. It wasn't a union. We just said, you know, don't do that, put your fucking specs on, you know, because people have been blinded there and stuff, you know. And, anyway, but that's my experience, and it was a lot of similarities. And they did not, and people said we did, they, you know, we'll, people were up for getting a union, but the, and what they didn't realise was there was kind of this thing, well, the company doesn't like it. But that, if that group of workers, that 50 lab workers, technicians, had gone on strike, they would have shut down Dowgate Spillers in the whole country very quickly, because they, you know, there would have been no testing, they couldn't have done it, you know, put these feeds out or anything. So sometimes workers are not aware of anywhere near of how much power they have, and that was what we used to argue all the time. I mean, sure.
A few disparate points. The you go into Koch laws and stuff, and that would be in the first stage is making individual workers responsible. It's the same on building sites and stuff, and also that made it possible when you outsourced and fake self-employed. To make it even less effective, they're going one stage further on build sites, which is like passport to health and safety, which not only are you responsible, is that you have to check things like a set of scaffolding whether you think it's safe or not. So you are totally responsible. Yeah. There is not even, I mean, I'm not a scaffolder, I can't check whether the scaffolding's okay. The only person who can check that is the company or the qualified scaffolder. See, it's got even worse to get.
And you know, you've got to pay for that.
So the company...
Oh yes, of course.
I mean, you ended up suing a worker who didn't check after another worker got injured.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you already pay for it anyway with, CSCS card. So it's one stage again where you're responsible for everything, and they're responsible for nothing. So they've taken it again further.
Well, to a certain extent, I know we're right there, but that film there is talking about when you go to the factory, you start to talk about collective social responsibility for producing stuff, don't you? When you start to talk about, you know, we're all in this together because some of us consume these products, some of us make them, you know, some of us transport them. Mm-hmm. So you start to talk about, because that's why I call it, it's kind of not communist demand, but communist movement, because you start to talk about the whole process, you talk about whether we need to do it or not, who's affected by it, and the fact that it's a social responsibility, not, you know, it's not like trying to make the capitalists responsible, because they have whole teams of lawyers to make sure they don't, financial responsibility.
At the same point, it also demonstrates that what people are in there, the workers run the enterprises already. That's why work to rules work, because if you follow the rules of how it's supposed to work, it doesn't work, it collapses. We're already in technical control of the word enterprise, it's ours already. We understand how it works, how it doesn't work, how it should work. Anything like that would be great. It's obviously going to be good.
What happened to the autonomists? I missed I missed presentations before, I just came in at the end. But what happened to the movement?
Well, as a social movement, it sort of died off and fragmented. A lot of the...
So it's based around kind of particular, like that point.
Yeah, there was a sort of technical composition of capital at that time, and capitalist development, where it was... The power of the autonomous capital movement being rigid and together, and they sort of diffused the factory, decentralised, making networks, put the burden of possibly on the independent operators and things like that, self-employed people. But which is why we've seen a lot of the most important work-based sponsors to the things over the past 5 years have been like the independent contractors in the oil refineries and things like that, or the oil tankers and that sort of thing, independent trials. But as social movement sort of died, the academic leaders, they picked them off one by one, they all went to jail or shut up or just spun away from actual social movement on the ground.
How many people they put in prison then?
It was about 900, I think.
Yeah. They had a thing called, I mean, you could probably correct me, but there was the Red Law, wasn't there? And then one of the laws was they could arrest you, charge you, and hold you on remand for up to 10 years without trial. Wow. So basically, what they did was
very clever association.
Yeah, it was based around that, but they just picked all the activists up, and the kind of militants, you know, and stuck them in prison, and they left them there. And then, some were released after a couple of years, some were not.
A lot of the energy of the movement did go into the temple after.
Yeah. Which is why we want no defence campaigns. That's my big thing. No defence campaigns, because they convert the struggle into a defensive mode, and you don't want to do that.
No, some set up social centres in the 80s as kind of refuge.
So it's quite a mixture of fragmentation.
Retreat, drugs, a lot of people, conspiracy groups, drug distributors, hard drugs, this sort of stuff. But yeah, fragmentation. And this, I wanted to see the Disobedientes film, which shows how they did develop forward in the 80s and 90s, which way, not all good or all bad, but. Because everything sort of went wrong time-wise that they didn't happen. It's a worthwhile film to watch in the future. I mean, if you get a chance to do something,
it's
the
Disobedientes film could be at some point.
Yeah.
Be good.
I'm trying to fix that.
Yeah, the heroin thing's interesting. Because all the Italian actors I met, they all talked about that. Said that, you know, I mean, they're not conspiracy theorists, but they did say that you know, the introduction of heroin into the Bologna scene was massively destructive by, like, the 80s. Like, demolished it in a lot of ways, like, you know, there's all sorts of problems, like, so there is a conspiracy theory, but I also think it's probably a product of fucking
demoralisation
as well, you know, sort of been there and then they can't go back to normal life, so it's a substitute.
But you can have both, the feedback is that you can have both and feed each other.
Percy trying to avoid heroin.
I know. What? Yeah.
And also the usual careers, like Tronti, I think, went back to the Communist Party. Caccieri, he was mentioned, he became the mayor of Venice, I think. And it's kind of some of the leading figures also made it quite.
So it was that kind of co-option.
As well, yeah. I think wherever you had repression, you had the restructuring of the industry, you had the drugs, you had the career. They brought in everything.
A whole lot.
So, like the 80s, I mean, what was European kind of backlash, really? Volker shock plus heroin. And
what was the decisive factor? I mean, talk about the state of depression, but at one time you were saying that you didn't understand why, but there was this, the state kind of collaborated with the Communist Party and the Communist Union to get. Those people back in charge of the factories because they lost control. Yeah. And then you say that, you know, you weren't sure why that was sort of easy or whatever, but there must be something behind that.
So I understand. I think they're called internal commissions. They were basically the bodies set up to, as the worker representatives, meet with the bosses in the factories. And I can't remember whether they were boycotted by the people. But they wanted to be brought in, or whether they were just they actually changed and went back to the PCI and CGI. I don't think they went back. I think they were boycotted and the rules were twisted, every single thing possible. And I'm obviously wishful thinking on my part, but they did come back in the start of the crisis in the oil shock period. They did manage to take back the factories. I don't know why. I really don't know why. Well, that's instructive of what you're saying. If people can be represented within the system, you know, might be a later part of that. It's possible.
The other thing about the health and safety thing is when union reps got replaced with company men, as goes health and safety reps, is that you had more bump about health and safety and less effect. Like they go through the motions of health and safety, while the things making things actually more unsafe. Like for instance, like on building sites, wearing gloves all the time, which may sound silly, but if you're wearing a drill, you just get your fingers ripped off. Or wandering around the site in the height of summer with goggles, with diggers flying everywhere, which get messed up, which is actually more unsafe. Whereas they completely ignore things that are actually unsafe, so they go through the motions.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah, because the workers are pretty good at actually working out half the time what cause if you do a job, what's safe and what isn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always naivety, like I'm just pointing out.
Yeah.
It's just experience. One of the other things I was going to talk about really briefly was some oral history that was done around communist militants in the 1990s, I think. There's some historians did was to record older communist militants who'd been involved at the end of the Second World War, you know, in the rising heart of Germany and all this partisan stuff in 1943. Onwards, and there was this very interesting, it's kind of used in sort of theory of history stuff to exhibit the ideas about myth, and why myth, when people give a testimony, why what they say that appears to be a myth should not be ignored, because if you do objective history, you kind of, if somebody says, comes up with a story like an urban myth, you're kind of meant to dismiss it and say, well, that's not objective, you know, it's not really history. But what they showed was that the stories people tell are very instructive about where they were or what their desires were at the time. And they found that all over Italy and interviewed old communist militants and, you know, socialist militants, and they, particularly communists, and what they kept coming across this story, right, that would come up in all these different cities all over, you know, building workers in, you know, in the south and, you know, industrial workers in the north. And the story basically went like this, and it would be old blokes talking about it, saying, I remember, you know, when the end of the Second World War, and we had the guns, we defeated the Nazis in the north, you know, we kicked them, we'd overthrown Mussolini, and like, we were in a position of power like Kieran mentioned, and we, you know, that we wanted revolution. And he said, I remember this story, and this is the story that was echoed all around the country. I remember when the secretary of the Communist Party came to speak in my, you know, my town, like, and we went down there and confronted him. You know, we were all there going like, you know, this now is the time, you know, this is the time, you know, we want the order to go, you know, we'll go and we'll seize power, you know, there will be a revolution in Italy, right? And they confront him, and of course the communist secretary goes on, you know, no, the time is not right, and, you know, we need to compromise, and, you know, and there's this bitterness when they tell this story. But the interesting thing was, is that in most of the cases, I think the expression they used, a sparrow flight only flies, it's something Lenin said once, but this came up as well. They kept saying, oh, the sparrow only flies by once. So you've got to shoot the sparrow when it flies by. That was the kind of expression in Italian, you know. So now is the time. And they all were all bitter about it. But of course, when you actually look into the history, the secretary never went to any of these places. It never happened. Well, technically, it never happened. There was never a confrontation. But what it meant was all these communist workers all over the country wanted that confrontation, you know, they wanted, and they felt totally sold out. I mean, that definitely comes through in the oral history. That the moment was 1945, that was the moment, right? And it could have been done. And there's such bitterness, but it's very, anyway, that I think is a lot of what you've mentioned there, that, you know, the kind of, I think, of the most militant sections of the Italian working class would absolutely, you know, that's where a division between the Communist Party leadership and the class occurs, you know, definitely amongst the most militant sections. And so they didn't trust each other after that. They might have voted for it, but they didn't trust
each other. Yeah, but there's no organic sort of link where we aren't a party that binds us anymore. That had gone on that point. Because of that point.
Also, what was interesting is, like, they mentioned the first documentary, The Fear of or you mentioned it actually, the fear of comeback of fascism in the 60s, how psychologically this was strong to actually stick people's support for Communist Party together, which I didn't realize before that they faced such questions in the 60s. Because, as you said, there were fascists spread around, still were active in hierarchical positions.
That's what they started at the moment again, and this was Greece. They said, like, okay, if you don't accept the austerity, you know, there is always a danger of a fascist coup. So, and they do that in Germany as well. Just like showing a little bit that democracy and globalization does really go together, and it's kind of very. At the moment, they show. Somehow, like in the background, democracy is not something that always has to exist. I mean, they just, you know, discuss that in their little bourgeois kind of discourse, just saying, okay, the, you know, there's a link between expanding market and liberal kind of attitudes, and now this austerity, if we don't accept it, get back on track. Other options are there, but that's one thing. The other thing, at least in Italy, is okay. The struggles went up to a point where they actually faced their kind of, to a certain extent, material limitations at that time. I mean, the big industry went out, you had the strike days up to whatever, inflation. I mean, this type of struggle, came to an end, and a certain section, at least then in the 80s, of whatever, the medium strata, maybe white-collar workers, at Fiat as a symbol, went on, you know, on to the streets and said, this can't, you know, go on like this forever. And it's true. I mean, you, as you said, you have a moment where you, whatever, can, a movement is kind of expanding and going from whatever the factory still has an organizing element, but it's still very connected to what's happening in the, whatever, in the reproduction sphere. If that is kind of cut, you know, this kind of link, and that was cut by whatever, 73, 74, then, I don't know, at some point you've got a strata of society saying, okay, all this kind of struggling, we want to go back on track. And at the moment, it would be interesting, who would be that strata in England, for example? What about all these kind of, let's say, people who are connected somehow to the financial bubble, who are not like managers, but like whose job around whatever 40,000 annual income, very kind of maybe alienating job, but somehow like, you know, around there, I don't know, would they, especially with the financial bubble, like London, always think like when he goes to city, do I have to see these people as whatever potential comrades in the demonstrations, you know, the suits, and I know that most of them are office workers, probably standing at the copier most of the time, but you can't know, you know, it's kind of a very strange, you know, they're not coming out of a factory, they come out of these office blocks, and as someone who doesn't really work much in these kind of, in the city, for example, you know, it's a very strange situation, but there's not much discussion about that.
Same, yes. Okay. As you were saying about the middle class, what's interesting is
middle class.
I don't know about middle class.
What's that?
I'm not sure they're middle class.
That's what I'm going on to say. What I'm saying is, what's interesting in the 80s and 90s particularly is the middle class has been split between lower and middle, and the lower basically have working class claims to give them 0 hours, unlimited labels, all the rest of it, and this, they really, you can't really differentiate them working class at all, so Bob Emery called them pink collar, because they're kind of middle class disability, massive debts, student, massive housing costs, and crap wages, 0 hours, and the upper middle, which are kind of the real managers. So in some ways, I think
Well, I think that's interesting. I mean, I don't think, where's it coming from is what you say, isn't it? Well, I'm not sure about, whether that. I mean, I think about agency. I know there's this sort of material basis for things and all that, but I believe in agency, and I think that things can take, you know, the level of consciousness can expand quite rapidly at different times. I certainly think that even with this movement we've got going now, what's absolutely key, and I think this goes for a lot of social struggles, is that you have to, you've got to get some results. And if you don't get results, you need to change what you're doing quickly, and try something else. But, a lot of the time we follow these paths of, standard struggles and what you do, and then it fails, and then everybody goes, oh, well, that's it. And then somebody talked about the other day, a culture of defeat. that goes on in, I think, somebody argued that in sections of the left there was a culture of defeat. So the culture is symbolic protest, but basically defeat.
Glorious defeat.
Glorious. Well, you're not even glorious these days. Yeah, but you're right. And I think the point is that you, yeah, I think I can see a movement spreading through, like, kind of vertical collars, white collar workers, definitely. I mean, if you know, if they're being squeezed, particularly in the southeast, things got really bad, because there isn't actually, you know, I've got to say it, but if anybody's going to starve in, say, the underclass, whatever that is, it's going to happen in the southeast, isn't it? Anywhere else, I don't think, because it, you know, those sort of London places like that, you know, it really is too expensive to live. Mm. You know, I mean, I think that if that became that kind of misery was really unleashed on people who are earning 30 grand a year, because they spend so much on having to travel, pay for houses, and, you know, all that, and then you might see something. Yeah. But it might also exhibit itself as something else, you know, perhaps some sort of it could be affected by nationalism, it could be affected by, you know, national socialism, in effect, you know, so we've got to be a bit careful about that. I don't accept the question, no.
It's just like, for example, in Greece we were able to see a generational division in the, whatever, you had the demonstration after the guy got shot, like, in December, what was it, 2008 or 9?
A year ago,
yeah. So that was like the whatever they called it, the 600 euro generation, the whatever, those kind of the generation that would never get like a, whatever, permanent job, plus the migrants, plus some students. And it was very like, okay, rioting, everyone likes it, but also like trying, you know, some kind of assemblies, neighborhood. No one really knows how actually these neighborhood assemblies was a bit of a mess, maybe, as well, an urban mess. But we heard about like new forms within this kind of rioters week, occupation, and then whatever, half a year later or something, the general strike of the public sector workers, much more force in the sense that they can stop a country, you know, if the port workers are involved and the transport workers, but very, still very much okay, march to the parliament. So somehow you had a kind of division of whatever, the more generational division than anything else, really. I don't know, at the moment I would see that in the public sector, like the public sector in England being in itself kind of fragmented, but also like quite separate from, let's say, the wider, at least in London, wider kind of whatever, private service sector or something. So the question is, what could be the link? What is the organic link? The cuts, maybe the cuts create this? I don't know.
Living wage?
That's the vehicle. It's kind of okay. We see the material kind of, you know, the problem of material division. I would say that it's a bit of okay, a demand that could bridge it. It's a kind of reflex, but it's maybe not looking at what kind of undercurrent whatever dynamics are there, what actual potential links. So you try to say okay, by putting forward a demand, everyone can gather. Yeah. But it's a bit of a lefty, I don't know.
But you can go to other things afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the organic links are really important, though, because what you're talking about, because these, you know, what's going on with this cuts thing, I mean, it's clear that, you know, one of the, I mean, John Pienaar, who's like the political correspondent for BBC, he's kind of main political commentator, he said one of the interesting things the other day when he said, well, you know, the main defence that they've got, you know, which Cameron's definitely aware of and talking about, is the fact that, you know, it is death by a thousand cuts. It's like there is no, he said that they're aware that there is no central rallying point around this big attack, you know, on all fronts sort of thing. They're attacking on all fronts. And there's no, the whole game is played around the fact there's no central rallying point. Well, like in the poll tax, you had the poll tax. What they're arguing is the cuts are everywhere. Yeah. So that means you're going to have an awful lot of disparate, small reactions.
10% of everything.
And that, they're hoping for that. They're hoping for no pole of resistance. Mm. Like I said, so there's a very postmodernist struggle where everybody's running around fight for their own little bit, and, you know, not really aware of what the other bit means, and, you know, and offers itself up as like, you know, they can start playing games, can't they, say, well, what's more important, your bit of green field, your playing field, or your library, you know, maybe the library we could do something with. So I think that's the biggest problem, is that there is, and we're already seeing it. We've not seen a general reaction, everyone's going to wait till next year, everyone's going to react, you know, but we've got the students reacting, and there's some, a little poll around that. But, you know, fucking up today, where were the unions today?
But in this sense, I mean, maybe not putting forward the demand, but it, maybe it's a similar lefty reflex, but to say EMA is a cut in a household wage. It's not that they take the pocket money out of the kids, it's it's a proletarian wage and they cut a bit of it. So at least put that idea forward. It's also like, a, let's say, maybe an abstract attempt to unify something which is not unified yet. But you don't have to invent any kind of demands. You can just say they cut a household wage. You know, it's kind of...
So I think I don't know if maybe the when you see these kids who, well, I'm probably making guesses here, but it seems like with the EMA stuff, I mean, it wasn't all that long ago, I remember, because I was sort of like the first generation to get any kind of EMA, and I got like 150 quid a term, something like that, and I was like, wow, this is amazing, free money. And spent some of it on something useful, most of it, of course, just on nothing. But these kids today, I think they've really come to expect it. But I think it's a very, very defensive, just kind of like, oh, I might not get any more money. What do? I run down the street kind of thing. It doesn't seem, unfortunately, I mean, maybe I just don't read Facebook enough or something, but like, it doesn't seem like it's going to... It doesn't fill me with hope for the future, unfortunately. Like, it's good to see angry people, but they seem so unfocused and so... And I really get pissed off with this kind of idea that you can go on Facebook and say yes to something. I like bad cup group. And it's like,
I think it seems to be waking them up to... younger students, that there is something going on. It's the first like little stab of like this is actually going to affect you now. And I think some of them are starting to go, okay, there's something wider going on here, and we're prepared to stand up and shout.
It's good, I think, that people want to stand up. I don't know, it seems so unfocused, and I just can't see any kind of, say, rallying point. There's no kind of, it's a thousand cuts of everything, isn't it? I mean,
this is what I've chatting about last night, but I've been thinking about, you know, because I've got to say now, I liked interacting with old students and the way they've behaved and what they've done, and they're
and they don't seem to be stupid. They seem to they see police techniques.
It's definitely a learning process. And I say, I think you're totally right. I think a lot of those kids will react to the MA team. But I'll tell you, there's a lot more going on than that. First of all, people fucking hate the police. Those kids actually are treated badly by the police. Like, you know, the students, they're pretty safe where they live, but these kids don't live in Clifton or up nice places. They don't live there. They live in other places. And there's definitely a different relationship with the police, clearly, you know. You know, one lot's taking numbers, you know. Having a go at them. Which actually is a divide, because one of them's working through a legalistic...
The
students is different. But what I think is to try and think, well, if it's a limited EMA type thing and the death by a thousand cuts, how do you overcome that? Well, my feeling was, I was thinking about this, it's like, well, the obvious thing to do is to connect those school students with their families, or with their friends or where they live, because, you know, I actually think that it would be more effective to have those students, well, they could do their demonstrations, but they need to be engaging with where they live, you know, with their own families, and so that's why I'm doing it. And I'm sure that loads of parents, we met a school teacher out there today, who, from Fairfield, he said, this guy Gary, a punk mate of ours, and he just goes like, well, yeah, it's brilliant. He said, 50 students walked out the first one. And he said, and the most interesting thing is I got in trouble straight away because he'd supported the anti-cuts demonstrations. But then they said, are you condoning it, whoever the school authorities were? And he said, no, I didn't condone them walking out, but I definitely condone people going on the demonstration. So the teachers have to be careful about what they say, because they can get in trouble. But what was really interesting was that that he said that the parents, when they, these 50 kids walked out, the school went to discipline them.
Yeah.
Every single parent wrote in supporting them, right, and said, I support my child doing this. He's fully aware of what's going on. You know, blah, blah, blah. And so there's a struggle going on in schools now, and possibly in colleges around this. You know, which again, you know, that's that idea needs to go out. Yeah, get your mum and dad to write a letter and say, you know, you've got to defend them. But you know, that's an interesting connection, though, isn't it? Because you've got families backing up their striking kids, effectively. Which you know, those sort of things need to be. They need to be things we need to talk about. Yeah, public meetings in those areas. You know, I want to see a student and their mum and dad, although probably won't do it, on the same stage, and mum and dad saying, "Yeah, I support my kid for not going to school." You know, and technically, you're in trouble. Do that, I think.
Mm. You know, one thing that has given me
refusing to school.
I work in a little shop up by the university, so whenever the students have been out on protest, it's totally affected the whole area, and everybody seems to have an opinion. So it's been kind of like a bit of a talking point. And I haven't yet come across anybody or talked to me. It might be that people who don't talk to people in shops are all closet right-wing people, but you know, everybody's sort of gone, it's great to see them out, and that's really good, I think, that everybody I've talked to anyway, I mean,
ready to shop?
On Park Row, up there. Yeah.
Well, I think the low-wage economy is central to this crisis, as much as, you know, when the overcapacity in the 70s, which led to any Keynesian boost leading to inflation and differential inflation, where the rich tried to grab more of the, you know, zero-sum gain by having differential wage inflation. So what they went is they went for a low wage at its rip to kind of force down wages, structural unemployment, and then go to a means-tested point trap to control wages to overcome the crisis of profit in the 70s. So you have, because this crisis is so based on a manufactured low-wage economy, you do have to attack that. And the other problem with what's happening at the moment is that the argument is sort of not entirely one, but a lot of people accede to the fact, oh, there is a massive budget deficit that we have to deal with. And I've come up, because it hasn't been challenged, where this budget deficit has come from, which is low wages. Yeah. The Tesco has been subsidised billions of pounds by the taxpayer by having a subsidised slave workforce while at the same time not paying taxes. So a kind of a living wage, it allows you to go into all these arguments, is what I think.
I was doing it for time for going to train station.
Yes.
Five to six.
Five to six,
right. Yeah, well, we've got time, but
I don't know the local arrangement.
7 o'clock.
Yeah, I have to get the tickets in these kind of strange situations where no one is paid to service you. But I think, the left should do a bit more, even if it's just propaganda, and say, okay, the EMA plus that, the change in housing benefit that young people can only move out with 35. They compress it in a way that certainly will create tension. I mean, at the moment they're still kind of supportive, but if you squeeze the resources and make people live together, I mean, it's just like, you know, then you if you see the whole picture, it's basically you can see what seems as very kind of desperate, like segregated cuts. It trickles down, and then it trickles down in household income.
Yeah.
Cuts of a nursery here and there, and people, you know, because it's so wide in a range, it's not. It hasn't trickled down into whatever the monthly,
That, that is really interesting, because it actually, if you think on the poll tax, it was suddenly clear to everybody, that's 500 quid they want or something, you know, or whatever it was, or 700 quid. I remember, at the time, one of my 6,500 quid, because I was still working at a chemical place, I couldn't actually afford it. I mean, it was quite weird being political and going I know this is wrong, but actually it doesn't matter because I can't bloody pay it. And I'm working. Because that's what they forgot. It was low-wage workers who got really hammered by the poll tax. It wasn't the unemployed, actually. it was the low pay, and that's in fact a sector they don't really want to fight again, I don't think, because they lost. But but what I would say is
interesting.
But it was concentrated, wasn't it? You could see how much money they were robbing off, or, you know, that you were going to be affected by. With all these cuts, you're right, it's not going to be obvious, is it? Because there's a tenner here and 20 quid there, and that cut, and well, I've got to pay for this now, I've got to pay for that. And that's the problem. It's like, it's not always visible, is it? It's
the Vodafone like seems to have caught the imagination. There seems to be the new McDonald's on the march.
And then there's the Top Shop
group.
What's it?
The Top Shop group. The other side.
The tax avoidance.
Boots has been having that as well, because they need their tax to Switzerland and they to avoid it.
One of the things I think that I can't get my head around is partly it's going to be geographical as well. I mean, I know up on the northeast, maybe, because I think it's so different from Bristol. I think, in terms of its economic outlook and kind of there isn't that, you know, unless you go up to the Yorkshire Moors and around, you know, the nice areas like that, you don't get so much disparity of wealth. Say you get in, say, Bristol, if you go from one bit of Bristol to another, it's kind of quite homogenous. So that's quite interesting that way, and also because that area now, because of the shutdown of the main industries, is very dependent on local government and public kind of employment. But at the same time, if you get rid of workers in the cuts, you're also getting rid of their benefits as well, getting rid of the disability benefits, trying to get people to work and stuff like that. And lots of people are on those kind of benefits in these areas. It'll be interesting to see. You can be squeezing those people at two ends then, really, both in terms of their employment and in terms of their benefits. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. But I often think that, what's to stop it from just becoming somewhere in the United States, Detroit or something like that, where it's just a complete immiseration rather than a struggle, What kicks off struggle? What keeps people in a state of kind of passivity?
Well, that's what you fear, isn't it? I mean, I fear that. I mean, it's all very well, all is going to be, crime and drugs, but when you say things like that, it's like, it's real, it's not funny. Yeah. You hear a lot of people say, I'll descend into chaos, almost like they want it. Like, I don't fucking want any of that. I don't want all of that. That's rubbish. And that's why I think, although I was out there shouting, let's go shopping, and, let's people talk about shoplifting's in, shopping's out, shoplifting's in, because we're not going to be able to afford it. But the problem with all that is that there is a tendency to sort of go down that route of mass social crime, proletarian shopping and all that. The problem is that I've got to say, in general, I've never seen that. I've never seen that proletarian shopping of the autonomous movement, which is all
the Spanish, the 20s. It did happen there, but it was on a mass social basis.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like people imagine the people going in nicking, it was like the moral economy of riot. It was just you're charging a quid, it should be 50p.
I mean, things like this thing about the Italian fairs stuff, the fines, do you know about this? Where,
okay.
Yeah, we basically on the these big groups of commuters set their own sort of structure. This is recent, and it comes kind of from the autonomy. The fair dodger union, you pay your money in and you pay money in, and it's much less than paying tickets for a month. If you get caught, then the organisation pays your fine.
No.
So
you try to do it in London, too individualistic.
Yeah, but that's interesting, isn't it? Because that sort of stuff, fine, mass social crime, but organised and sort of upfront to a certain extent. But this whole descent into the black economy, drugs, petty crime and all that sort of anarchy. I mean, we already saw that in the 80s, and it affected communities massively. I don't think the effect. People talk about Southmead, for example. I've done quite a lot of work on Southmead. Southmead's really interesting because I would say prior to 1980, perhaps the late 70s, that community, there was still the kind of working class pride. Most people worked up at BAC and Rolls Royce or British Aerospace and worked up there. A lot of people worked in those things. People worked in the health services, obviously the hospital and all that. And there was a kind of pride. And the criminal families were very a minority and they were sort of seen as a bit weird. But there was a lot more sort of you didn't do black economy, you didn't really do that kind of stuff. You didn't, I don't need to do shoplifting, petty crime, selling drugs or anything like that. But when after the 80s, after that collapse and, all these workers losing their jobs and that sort of thing in the 80s, you do get across the whole country, whole areas, all sections of the workplace have changed because the children are being brought up by parents who are doing petty crime and black economy and all that sort of stuff. It becomes a culture. And I would say that the biggest problems with crime in Bristol was you've got whole areas that were dispossessed in that period in the 70s, and now there's a culture of petty crime and black economy and all that sort of stuff. And I've argued quite a lot with anarchists about this, because I actually don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a good thing at all, actually. And I'm not saying I want the kind of disciplined, pride, world-class working for the capitalists. I'm talking about, I don't actually think that's a, you know, that's a response, but it's not necessarily a cohesive response at all. You know, it makes people get
very defensive, isn't it?
What do you mean?
It's
a material response,
yeah.
But it's not really what. There's better things to be done than that, but that means organising and fighting as a community. And I don't think, you know, most. It's really sad to see these communities now, you know, where people don't. I mean, I say community in inverted commas because I don't know what that means, but you know, it's more complicated. But there's serious problems, and people are really pissed off, and that's forced a lot of people out of those communities as well. Like, people are a bit better off escaping because of this horrible reality. Now this whole concept of the chav, you know, which is where half of this comes from, and the whole concept of the working class being in council estates on the edge of towns and all, it's a fucking nightmare. We'd go there, you know, it's terrible.
Well, I mean, this is one of the things that was the contradiction as well, because when, you know, in Middlesbrough, really, really high unemployment, lots of crime, one of the highest crime areas in the UK, and, you know, who did they vote for? As mayor, with Robocop, you know, the guy who said he's going to have no enforcement, what were they called? Sorry, enforcement areas anyway, where there was going to be no kind of crime and stuff like that. But the people in Middlesbrough, working class people, voted for that because they were seeing that whole destruction, you know, that crime and drugs and whatever. And it was one response then was to say, right, okay, we can't do anything about it, let's get the state to be really tough, you know.
But the other thing I kind of miss that is that organised crime and demi-organised minor crime is essential for states to work. I mean, like, at least I've nearly charmed just on a connection between straight capitalism and organised crime, and, you know, little chiselers at the bottom. It's essential, isn't it, as a form of social control if you're going to impoverish people, that, you know.
You need social control, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if they're even going to bother with that now. A big society will mean that they will reduce people policing in some areas, I suspect.
No, I mean organised crime as a
what I'm saying is the state should cause by people, they just don't bother about them anymore. Don't worry about it too much, you know.
Leave areas.
People are frightened and stuck in their houses if they're
open. Well, it's ideal, that's what I'm saying.